Good morning. My guest this morning is Steve Wakila. Right now, the information says that he is the new mayor-elect of Florence. There are still some debates and still some questions, and I'm quite sure a few more court battles to take place before we have a final result in this race. If you have been keeping up with this race, you know that Mr. Wakila actually won by one vote, and that's been challenged. It was challenged on Saturday in Columbia at the Democratic Committee. It's been challenged in Florence at the Florence Election Committee. And right now, Mr. Wakila has reigned at the top of the race and will hopefully represent Florence. Will hopefully represent Florence in terms of being the mayor of Florence after the November election. Good morning, Mr. Wakila.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for having me.
When you first heard that you'd won by one vote, what was your immediate thought?
It was emotional, really. We were counting the votes as they came in. We were getting votes from different precincts, and we knew we had votes in particular precincts, and we could see the votes coming in, and it was a dramatic ending there with one vote. But we were excited and enthusiastic and shocked, really.
Did you think it would hold up?
Yeah. We did. I believe from the beginning that it would hold up, and that the idea that everybody's vote counts was true and was significant. Larry, I must have had hundreds of people tell me that I was that one vote, Wakila. I was that one vote that won the race for you. And the truth of the matter is, everybody was. It took every single person together to do this, and it's inspirational, really.
So where do you go from here?
Well, as a practical matter, the procedure that's been followed thus far is this. Of course, one on election night, there were some provisional ballots that were counted the following Thursday, the 12th. I was still ahead by one vote. There was a recount that was mandatory because the margin was less than 1%. That was held on the following Monday, and still I was ahead by one vote. Then Mayor Willis filed a protest. That protest was heard by the state Democratic Party this past Saturday in a hearing, Larry, that lasted 8 hours.
So. I understood. I heard that. Like, at news time, they couldn't call it.
Oh, man. We started that hearing at 2 o'clock. They must have had 10 lawyers on their side, and they just went on and on and on, and it wasn't until 10 o'clock that the committee came back and rendered their decision to uphold the election and deny the protest. And so that we're still on a high from that and exhausted from that Saturday night. Now, the other side has a period of time to appeal that to the court system and ultimately to the South Carolina Supreme Court if they care to do that. I don't know if they will do that. I told the folks before Saturday that I would stand by whatever the Democratic Party did, and that if the Democratic Party had ordered a recount, that I wouldn't have appealed to the courts, because the whole impetus of what I was trying to do in this campaign was to bring people together. I feel that this is a city that's divided. I think this election demonstrates it absolutely, and that this protest and this contest continuing is further dividing folks. And I want to start the hard work of bringing people together again.
But why you and why now?
Well, I think there's an urgency of now. The problems that we have are getting to be so dire that we've got to do something about them, and we can't wait another day. I mean, you walk through some of these communities, Larry, that are being plagued by gangs and drugs. The property values are dropping. The fiscal situation is out of control. Gas prices are astronomical. People can't afford health care. People are in desperate situation right now, and we can't wait any longer for new leadership and change. That's one of the reasons I was so and am so strongly a supporter of Obama, because there is a feeling in this community and in this nation that hasn't been here for 40 years. And whether you were an Obama supporter or a Clinton supporter, you got to believe that the Democratic Party is the party that can bring change and can put this country back on the right course. And so that, and Obama has talked about the urgency of now, that we can't wait another day to start fixing these things that are so horribly broken.
If these results hold up, what do you do first?
Well, of course, this is the primary. Mm-hmm. And there isn't a general election until November. And of course, I would be the Democratic primary candidate after these results are certified and finally adjudicated. But it wouldn't be until after November that I would be the mayor, and then I would be sworn in late November. But I've told people that my first task within the first 90 days, 100 days of becoming mayor, would be to do something dramatic about these abandoned houses that plague our city. Now, a lot of people don't find that so significant. A lot of areas in the southern part of town, they don't see the problems that plague people with abandoned houses. But if you go particularly in the north side of town, you'll see, you go through neighborhoods where they're everywhere, and they cause all kinds of problems. Drugs and gangs get involved in those houses. They bring property values down, and there's something that the city can do immediately and bring immediate change to the quality of life of the people in Florence. So immediately after elected, one of the first things I'm going to do is compile a list of those abandoned houses that are out there, file petitions to have those houses condemned and demolished, and get that problem fixed immediately. Now, there's other problems that are urgent as well. We got to see to the city police getting the funding they need to have a real gang unit that deals with the issue of gangs. We got to see to it that a lot of these community programs that we have to get some of these young people off the street get more funding and get regular funding. The Camp Fever program is a very good program, needs more funding and needs year-long funding, for example. There are a lot of those types of things we need to do, but I think that issue of abandoned houses is something that can be addressed immediately and promptly and can bring immediate results and needs to be done.
You alluded earlier to the fact that the mayor has the option of going all the way up to the Supreme Court in terms of fighting this particular election. If he does that, what is your position? Will you just fight along with him on that particular standpoint?
Well, of course, we think the Democratic Party's decision should stand. We think that you can beat an incumbent 13-year mayor by one vote, and that we think every vote should count. And we're going to defend that position of the Democratic Party wherever he brings a protest. We'll certainly continue to fight that fight, and we're certainly not going to concede that point. I think it's very important that the people of Florence understand that when they got out there and everybody went out there and voted, that their vote did matter, and their vote's not going to be set aside because an incumbent thinks one vote's not enough. One vote is enough.
As you talked about pretty much two Florence in your campaign. You talked about the kind of upwardly mobile Florence, and you talked about the north side and the east side of Florence that were challenged in terms of economic development and growth. What will you do to heal that separation?
Well, as I see it, Larry, there's two things. One, the center of that division, as I see it, is downtown Florence.
Okay.
That is really the dividing line between north and south. And I say north and south. When I say north and south, I include in the north, northeast Florence, northwest Florence, and north Florence.
Mm-hmm.
The folks over in West Florence will get upset if you start calling them Northwest Florence. People on Dixie Street still say, listen, I live in West Florence, not Northwest Florence, but you understand what I say.
Exactly.
That dividing line is Evans Street, basically, and it goes through our downtown. That area, Evans Street and Dargan Street, that has to be healed. And what that means is a number of things have to be done. We have to stabilize the public safety situation in that area. We've got to get that dedicated gang unit to get in there and stabilize the crime situation in that area. Then we've got to get economic development in that area. And that, in my mind, means two things. First thing it means is to spend some of the money that we've been spending south of Evans Street, down there in the area of the library and the Performing Arts Center and the Little Theater. We've got to bring that money north to the true downtown. Okay. Second, it means we've got to encourage entrepreneurial development in that area. Now, I think once the city spends some money in that area and the county and the Bruce Lee Foundation spend some money in the true downtown, you will encourage entrepreneurial development because people will start coming there. But we also got to provide low interest and no interest loans for minority and small business people to bring business down there. And we got to see that whenever we do projects down in that part of town, in that downtown area, that we see to it that those minority and small business people get those contracts. And that's a real problem that has been out there and they haven't been getting this.
You talk about minority, especially minority business involvement and entrepreneurship in the downtown area, and you also talk about low-interest loans. Mm-hmm. There have been suggestions on the board for since downtown development started that said that maybe there should be some type of program to make sure that those buildings are affordable to small businesses, to some of the small businesses that currently occupy them, but beyond the ones that currently occupy them, the fact that there are people out there who are small businesses, not just African American businesses, but small businesses as a whole, who need to have ownership of the properties in order for them to be able to develop them and develop downtown. What is your position there?
I agree with that wholeheartedly. And not until you get small business people in there who have an ownership interest and have a business interest in that area being beautiful and crime-free and there being people down there, will you really get the kind of entrepreneurial development that you need downtown. And I think you're absolutely right. There is a real danger that in doing that kind of downtown development, you do gentrification or you run out small business people. We've got to be extremely cautious about that danger. Everybody's got to have a share and an interest in this project. And we can do that. We know, there are communities all around this country who have done exactly that. We just haven't been putting the force of our energy behind that in downtown. And I started saying that downtown was important because it's that dividing line.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to ignore the rest of the north area of Florence that I think is being getting the short end of the stick as far as the development and the improvements that the city needs to make as far as road paving and sewer lines and that sort of thing and water drainage. But that downtown, that dividing line, that wall that divides us, I think, is the thing that's got to be addressed primarily.
I had a friend in town from Greenville this past weekend, and we were riding through Florence, and we happened to ride through downtown Florence, and when we got on Oregon Street, they asked me, "What is this?" And I said, "This is actually downtown Florence." And they said, you're kidding me. I said, "No, this is actually downtown Florence." They said, "So why is it so black and so undeveloped?" I said, because unlike Greenville and unlike Charleston and unlike Rock Hill and unlike Columbia and most of the other cities in the southeast that have developed their downtown.
Even Hartsville,
Hartsville,
yeah.
Marion, Mullins, all those people that have developed their downtowns, and Conway is a classic example, we have not invested in the ownership capacity of downtown. And when we were doing our debate discussions over Francis Marion before the date, we had a luncheon over there, and we went around the table and we talked about how business avoids showing people who are coming to town to do business or to work in Florence, how they work around making sure people can't see.
Can you imagine
downtown that they actually have designed a pattern that takes them around downtown so that they don't have to see downtown? And Fred Carter told the story at this particular piece. He talked about a coach that he hired, and they signed a contract with the coach, and the coach was actually taking a ride around town to see what was going on in town. And as he rode around and took a look, they got a call back from him and his wife was crying and saying, "I can't live here. You know, I've seen downtown, and I can't live here." That's kind of what you got. You got meetings of people going to the beach. You have to ride through Florence to go to the beach. And that says a lot about what we've invested our money and what we're investing our resources in. How do we change that perception? How do we get around that?
Well, and it's a common story. And it's the story I experienced, Larry, because I have a lot of friends I went to school with. Of course, I grew up here. I went to the public high schools. And I went off to go to law school. And had that very conversation with my wife. Do we want to go back to Florence? And one of the drawbacks was the condition of the city, the condition of the downtown. She's from Augusta, Georgia, and it didn't have the draw that many of the other small cities had for people who are young professionals or entrepreneurs. We've got to attack that problem head on. We have been ignoring it. I mean, we pay a lot of lip service to having done downtown development. We've been paying that lip service for 10 years now, Larry, and everything we do goes south down Dargan Street, south of Palmetto Street. And until we really recognize that we have a serious problem downtown that's not going to be alleviated by building a breezeway and putting a couple benches down there, that we've got to address that problem and we've got to do that development that we've done south of downtown on Evans Street, then we never will do it. And I think we can do it. People act as if it's an intractable problem and it's unsolvable and there's nothing that can be done. It has been done all over the place.
It's fairly a simple process.
Yeah.
I mean, but from what I've seen, it's basically getting government grants, getting federal money.
That's right.
And using that federal money, there is some challenge, and I don't know whether you were alluding to this in the debate, there was some challenge as to who owns the property downtown.
Yeah.
And even some of the current people who are elected officials in this
yeah.
city who actually own part of that property and are using that as investment property,
yeah.
or people who run for political office who are using that as investment property and who don't have any interest in making sure that they don't get the top dollar for the land.
That's right.
And so they're not seeking the approach that they need to seek to it. Question in terms of how do you manage business with Lawrence County?
Well, we've got to bring everybody to the table. I think for too long, Florence has been, in many ways, an exclusionary city.
Mm-hmm.
It's closed door. People aren't invited into the conversation. People aren't invited to participate. I mean, you think about it. Where were the meetings about where the library was going to be put? Where it was going to be put? Where were the meetings about where the little theater was going to be put? About the Performing Arts Center? I mean, we had a lot of meetings about those facilities, but when those crucial decisions were made, is what spot is it going to be on? Those things are made behind closed doors. There's a lot of exclusion, and I think you've got to have openness. You've got to have public decisions made in public. You've got to have an ability to communicate with your leaders and a belief that your leaders are going to be frank and honest with you and tell you what they believe and be up front. Larry, people are not always going to agree with me. If you can get five people in a room to agree to anything, somebody in there is probably lying.
Yeah.
But you got it. People don't expect to agree on everything. People expect you to be open and honest with them. Tell them what your position is. Tell them what you're thinking about. Tell them what the decision is to be made. Take input from everybody. Make the best decision and move on. And that's the kind of government we deserve, and that's the kind of government we need to have. And that's how we can mend fences. People don't expect to get their way all the time, but people do expect to be participating in the process all the time and to be dealt with honestly.
And I've got to ask you, do you really believe that? I mean, the challenge basically has been in this city and in this county and this region for so long, people have been kind of dictated to as to where to go and how to go and where things should go and how projects should move forward. So do you think the voters and the community as a whole are actually ready to take an active role in what's going on in this community? They've kind of allocated that to somebody, relegated that to somebody else for so long. Do you think they're ready to?
I think they're starved for it. People are starved to have that input and starved to make a change. And people have been, you're right, people have been isolated and have been cut out of the system for so long that they've got a lot of anxiety and frustration and irritation with the system, and that doesn't do anything but suppress people's input, and that's been suppressed for a long time. But I tell you what, you ignite that fire and ignite the idea that people can make a change. This election is a perfect example. We've had record turnouts, and people are inspired with the idea that, listen, we can really do something. And we've got to facilitate that.
What do you think the impact of your, if these results hold up, what do you think the impact of your election will have on young political people in the community?
I tell you what, it has an impact beyond our community. I was talking with Ryan Cooper the other day. Ryan Cooper was the regional director for Obama in the PD area during the primary seasons. And I got very close with Ryan and a lot of the other Obama people. And Ryan had told me, and I'm still close with him, I talk to him on a regular basis, he's out in Missouri right now, regional director for the Missouri area, but he said that the story of this campaign, this mayor's race, this one vote, the Obama and other people who've come out who were inspired and had never been involved in politics before, that overcame really opposition from all of the establishment on both sides. That story has been told by himself and other Obama organizers all over the country on the national and the local level to show people, listen, we can do it. One vote matters. Everybody can come together. It doesn't matter that the establishment and that the elected officials are opposed to a new movement. A 32-year-old who's never held public office before can beat a 13-year incumbent against the opposition of all the establishment and do it with the support of everybody in one vote. And that is how people know to get involved.
And so you think that, how does that look for young people? We've got a lot of talented young people who come out of the PD, who come out of South Carolina, who never want to come back. Do you think this will help in that?
I think it will. I think it will give people an idea that, listen, the new order, the new group of people is coming in, and we're gonna take control, and we're gonna make this city what it can be.
We're gonna take a break for a minute, and we'll be right back.
Thank you, Art.
Yes, you are listening to the Archangel, the King of Kings, who comes to Real Talk. This is the Monarchy Beholden to No One. And I'm holding back right now. I'm leaning back and letting Larry take the reins for today. Again, Larry Smith is the editor-in-chief and founder of the Community Times. And he's conducting an interview with the new mayor. I got to throw in one of my questions pertaining to censorship here, though. What are we going to do about the lack of letting other voices come through when it comes to networks and the radio stations and ownership of radio stations? Because me, being who I am, I was pushed aside off the air when it comes to certain owned the radio stations out here in the PD area. What can we do to bring a little bit more voice, to hear from more other people who are living in the community?
It's a common problem. I, as someone who's had to run and campaign for public office, it's an enormous problem of having a microphone to talk into. And I mean that literally and figuratively. There's a lot of exclusion of particular thoughts and ideas, and can be done fairly efficiently because of the monopolistic ownership of the airways and of the print media. And I think the answer to that question, though, really is in two parts. The first is having leaders that will speak to those issues themselves, first of all. Frankly, if you're the mayor, they can't but give you the microphone.
Right.
And secondly is the advent of technology. I mean, this precise type of communication, whether it's a blog or whether it's internet radio or whether it's other types of internet communications, communication has become much more facilitated, of course, by this type of discourse, and it's cutting out a lot of the traditional types of media, as you well know. And in fact, I think the traditional medias are having to run to catch up and cover what's already on the blogosphere or internet radio or the other types of communication on the internet. And so I think the answer is you're already doing it. You're already ahead of the game, and those old forms of media, I think, that have become monopolized are going by the wayside and will end up covering the internet. And I want us to go back to that first issue, though, about electing leaders that will speak to those issues.
Right.
A good example of it is the road tax, and Larry and I were talking about that a little when we were off the air. As you recall, some years ago, the establishment, for lack of a better term, was promoting a 1 cent sales tax for, they said, the improvement of the roads. Okay, and there was a massive media campaign on television, in the newspaper, editorials, letters to the editor, articles, all talking about how fantastic an opportunity it was for us to have this road tax to improve our roads. Now, of course, nobody was opposing the improvement of the roads. Certainly, in the north side of town, there are massive problems with infrastructure and roads in particular. And everyone agreed we needed improvement of the roads. But I got to looking at this issue, and Francis Marion did a study that they kept citing in support of having this road tax. And what it said was this. The 1 cent sales tax was going to generate about $150 million. All right. Now, it was sales tax, which meant it taxed most those who were least able to afford it, instead of raising that money based on property tax, which affects more wealthy people more heavily, or income tax, which you can have a progressive tax that taxes those more wealthy folks at a higher rate. They wanted to push that tax on the sales tax, which I disagreed with. But it was going to raise $150 million. All right. Now, I imagine that was their estimate a couple of years ago. I imagine that number has probably gone down, given the fact that the cost of everything has caused a decrease in purchasing. And every time we get into economic hard times, what we generate from the sales tax is reduced. Okay. We were going to get matching funds from the state of about $250 million. Now, they act like that was an economic windfall. We were going to get this gift from the state. Now, remember, those are our state tax dollars, too. So it's the great gift of being given our tax dollars back.
Right.
It wasn't so much of a windfall. We paid for that money, too. But together, that was going to raise about $400 million. They were talking about, I think, six projects. Okay, those projects were going to cost $600 million. Now, of course, remember, that was the cost a couple of years ago, before you had $4 gasoline. So I can guarantee you the $600 price tag has increased significantly, and the $150 million you're going to raise from sales tax has decreased significantly. But even then, they were talking about being $200 million short. So you knew there were more taxes coming down the line. And then if you looked into it further, you found that the roads that they were talking about improving, in fact, weren't going to do anything to repair the infrastructure, certainly in the city of Florence. What they were talking about was road expansion. They were going to expand Pine Needles Road, which is outside the city of Florence. Now, granted, Pine Needles Road needs expansion desperately, and the Department of Transportation should have paid to expand Pine Needles Road a long time ago. But I couldn't understand why we were going to pay more tax dollars in sales tax to get what we should have had already while we still weren't repairing the roads that were in the city. Other expansions they were talking about, down in Kingsburg, where incidentally and coincidentally, if you want to believe that, later on they tell us they're going to build a coal plant down there to improve properties of landowners way outside the city of Florence. None of that money was going to improve downtown or anywhere inside the city limits of Florence, or improve the desperately crumbling roads and water drainage systems we have. Worse than that, this year in the city budget, the city is sending $750,000 of city tax dollars money over to that Pine Needles project to move water drainage lines to improve that Pine Needles project. So not only did city taxpayers not get a single dollar of investment in the city from that sales tax increase, that increase didn't generate enough money to do what they were talking about doing, and city tax dollars that they have raised from us already that's supposed to go to improving city roads is going outside the city because they didn't raise enough money. Now, you didn't hear any of that. You didn't hear a word of that from all of the traditional media that were all out there supporting it, all the traditional elected officials and establishment were out there saying what a good deal it was going to be, it was going to improve the roads, and you're fools if you don't vote for this sales tax. And I opposed it. In fact, in order to oppose it, in order to get a word in edgewise, I had to buy, at the cost of a couple $1,000, an ad in the Florence Morning News, about a three-quarter page ad, in order to oppose that, in order to have a single voice in opposition. Now, that tells you how they can give the microphone only to those who are saying what they want them to say.
The editors can squash any story they want to in the back.
That's right, and squash everybody out. But with the word of mouth and with the internet and with leaders that will bring those issues to bear, we can overcome that kind of monopolistic control of communication. And if anything proves it, this election proves it.
Well, I'll be waiting for your forum to talk about this pretty much, because I'm going to be there for it.
I'll be there.
All right.
Even along those lines, the question becomes, you talk about media ownership. There are options out there that this community has not considered. Low-power stations, at low-power FM, mm-hmm. is one of those options out there. I know Leo Woodbury looked into the possibility a few months ago and was not able to obtain to get through the process at that particular point. But the challenge, basically, and I don't think it's, you know, we can address this issue to media in Florence and even the monopolies of media in Florence, but it actually seems to me to be a national issue.
Yeah.
Is anybody asking the questions, the tough questions, the hard questions anymore? It seems that in the days of corporate media, the bottom line seems to be more important than the truth and getting to the truth. Yeah. How do you get people to actually start to talk again and actually try to communicate and start to talk about ideas and talk about opportunities in the community when they're afraid that their voices are going to be stifled, when they're afraid that they're not going to get in the mainstream media? If you talk against a coal plant in Kingsborough, you're talking against the economics of this community and the growth of this community. If you talk against downtown development in its present form, you're talking against present leadership in this community, and you're not seen as a team player. And so many people have pretty much dropped out of the process. How do you bring those people back to this process?
And I want to say, too, and this is important, when I talk about the media that is exclusionary, this is, of course, present company excluded, Larry.
Exactly.
But you're absolutely right. And you can remember, as I do, the days when the newsroom was separated from the corporate office.
Absolutely.
And that has changed. And that is horribly unfortunate. And it's a vicious cycle. It feeds those that are in power, and those that are in power feed those media cycles, and all you get is an echo chamber. But you can crack that. And this election is an example that you can crack that exclusion. And if you've got leaders in there that are talking about those issues that have been forbidden before, then the media's got to cover. The mainstream media has got to cover those issues. And then if you get people who finally get the inspiration that, listen, we can really talk about these issues, we can really make a change, then they don't have a choice. They have to follow.
The question, honestly, the question is not at this particular point whether the mainstream media is covering the issues. I think they're very much covering most of the issues. The challenge becomes, are they asking the right questions?
Yep.
And because anybody can, I can do a story from my newspaper perspective, and I can see that same story. I'll give you a classic example. I was reading the state trooper story in the state newspaper yesterday, and they had some very, very fine and important points in this piece, and they talked about 80% 80 people being charged with some type of violation in terms of the troopers. They talked about the consistency of repeat offenders in terms of troopers doing things, the destruction of property, and all of those things. What they did not ask was, what's the solution here?
Yeah.
What we're asking right now to black elected officials across the state and black officials across the state about that issue is it time for a class action suit against the South Carolina Highway Department?
Yeah.
Is it absolutely time? Because in most of these cases, they were racially motivated.
Yeah.
And so is it time for a class action suit against the South Carolina Highway Department to get them back on to where they need to be? Because it seems that clearly they're out of bounds in terms of the way, I mean, when you look at the type of things that they talk about people doing, again, it goes back to what I was saying a second ago. Are the mainstream media asking the right questions?
Yeah.
I mean, and because if they're not asking the right questions, then we're not going to get the right answer.
I think the answer is they're not. The run-up to the Iraq War is a golden example of that. And you watch some of these frontline episodes about how they had press conferences and the media were handed questions to ask. and just it was all just a coronation of what was going on, and nobody challenged the administration on what in the world are you guys doing, why are you doing it, and how in the world do you plan to get us out of it once you've gotten us into it. The thing is, though, I think ultimately, if the media, and they're doing a better job, I think, now, of finally getting hard and asking some harder questions, certainly harder than they were 4 years ago or 6 years ago. And I think part of that is a response to the danger economically of being irrelevant. I mean, if you are just a mouthpiece of the administration and all you do is provide an echo chamber for them, people who are real critical thinkers start ignoring you. And they start looking for their news at other places. Exactly. And then you've seen that development of internet blogs and internet newspapers and that sort of...
And alternative newspapers. And I think that's right. That you're absolutely right. The challenge basically is that when we start to look at people and you know, one thing about mainstream media is they have some of the best research on the planet. So they know when they're going forward and when they're not going forward, when they're reaching the people and they're not reaching the people. And, you know, they've almost had to turn to kind of retrieve the audience that they're losing. They've almost had to turn to kind of the National Enquirer perspective on how they cover the news.
It becomes professional wrestling.
And it becomes professional wrestling, it becomes National Enquirer, it becomes, you know, it leads to journalism. And the challenge basically is if you become the mayor of Florence, how do you keep that open? How do you keep that communication open so people know exactly what's going on at all levels of the game? There was an argument also in the state newspaper yesterday about the openness of the process. At University of South Carolina in terms of selecting a president and how close that process was. And you kind of alluded to that in terms of how the process goes in Florence as a whole with things that are happening that are important to the community, but are never discussed in the community. How do you make that happen?
I make sure that things aren't done behind closed doors anymore. And I have a benefit because I'll have the bully pulpit. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, the media will have to cover and listen to what I say, which is an advantage over somebody who's running as a candidate. But let me speak to an example of that. The fire chief. You recall that not so long ago, we lost our fire chief, and the interim fire chief, Carlos Washington, took his position. Mm-hmm. Now, Carlos, by all accounts, is a fantastic fire chief and a fantastic individual. He's well-respected in the community. He's well-known. He did a tremendous job at a very difficult time, doing a number of things, among which primarily was repairing the relationship between the volunteer fire departments and the City of Florence Fire Department, so they could have a mutual assistance agreement. Carlos did a fantastic job. He stepped up at a difficult time and is well-known and well-respected. Came time to decide who was going to be the permanent fire chief while Carlos was serving as interim fire chief. And the city council made decisions behind closed doors, excluding even the Florence Morning News criticized him for these closed-door approach. Picked a candidate for fire chief, someone who was from out of state. I think the guy was originally from somewhere in Ohio, and he'd go down to Hilton Head or something like that, and didn't choose Mr. Washington and didn't give any real substantive explanation as to why not. Here you have in Carlos Washington a candidate that had all the credentials and all the qualifications you would want to be a fire chief, and as well known and tested and respected. And why did you pick someone from outside? Now, I don't know the fellow they picked as the fire chief, and I'm sure he's a fine fellow, and it wasn't his fault that they behaved the way they did. Now, I know Carlos Washington doesn't hold any ill will towards him and will do a fine job for this new fire chief. But it's an example of the way the elected officials and establishment make decisions behind closed doors, exclude the community, don't give any explanation, and then if they have people who do have connections to the community and do communicate well with the community, like Mr. Washington, they don't elevate them to a position where they could be at the head of a department. Instead, they pick somebody from out of town who doesn't have those kinds of connections and doesn't have that kind of community connection. And that's something that I would certainly do different as mayor.
What do you say to those people who would say that that's partially the community's fault for not being aware, for not demanding to know, for not participating in the process, for not showing up at the city council meeting or the county council meeting? What do you say to those people?
There's some truth to that. I mean, there is some truth to that. And until the community says, we've had enough of this, and we're going to make a change, then you'll get more of the same. But I tell you what, Larry, for the first time in a long, long time, I think the community's standing up on their hind legs and saying that. I mean, you're looking at a fella who's 32 years old and beat a 13-year incumbent who had the support of all the establishment. And I was able to do that because the people in the community finally got fed up and said, we've had enough of being spoon-fed, and we're going to make a change.
Along that line, since you bring us back to that point, what do you say to the people who say he took it lightly? He didn't campaign as hard as he should have. He didn't invest the resources. The last time I checked, the mayor was a millionaire. Yeah. That he didn't invest the resources in terms of economically. He didn't show up at any community meetings. He didn't do any of the things that a good candidate would do if he was serious about being reelected. Do you think that he may have underestimated you? He debated you in a debate that most people in the community thought was the worst move of the process.
Well, I would say that if the mayor had been well connected and had communicated well with the community, he would know what was going on. He would know the fever and the opposition that was growing in the community. You can't underestimate your opponent if you don't know, if you know what's going on and you hear the people in the community talking about what's going on. I mean, I built an enormous amount of support without him watching. And that says something about how closely he was watching his community.
He's a 13-year incumbent. He's got everything. We've got an economy that's moving on all cylinders. There are those who argue that the community has grown in spite of the bad leadership on the city level. In spite of the bad leadership on the city level, why would he have to take you serious? Why would he think that there was a real opportunity for a 32-year-old newcomer to even be a challenge?
Well, if he had spoken with a lot of the community leaders who were supporting me, he would know. I got a lot of support from the ministers in the community, for example. Reverend McAllister over at Mount Zion was a great supporter. I got a lot of support from Reverend Gamble, Reverend Diggs, and others. And I find it surprising that you could be the mayor of that community, know those community leaders, and not know that you were losing that support.
So what is your next step? What are the five things you'd like to see happen in the city of Florence?
Well, and as I said earlier, The number one thing I will do is address that issue of the abandoned houses. That zoning and code enforcement issue is an issue that can immediately and directly improve the quality of life of a number of people in a number of neighborhoods, help with the issue of public safety, and do it immediately. That is a number one issue, and that's something that I think is incredibly important. Along with that goes number two, which is public safety in general. I've talked a lot about giving the city of police more support, and particularly giving them the police officers they need to attack the gang problem head on and to have a dedicated gang unit. You know, we hear a lot about gang task forces and gang initiatives, but they're all just labels and talk. We've got to have police officers that are dedicated full-time to the issue of dealing with gangs, and we haven't had that. And that's not the police officer's fault. They work hard. They put themselves in dangerous situations, and they do it for not enough pay. But they haven't gotten the support they need, and we've got to give them the support they need. The third is also connected to those first two issues, and that is improving the quality of downtown Florence. And we've talked about that a lot today, Larry, but we've got to bring that money that's been going south into the true downtown, into the Evans Street, into the Dargan Street, and bring economic development to that area with low-interest and no-interest loans and bringing small business and minority businesses into that area and develop that area. Those top three things are just crucially important, and we've got to address that head-on. A fourth thing is infrastructure. We talked about I mean, you know, and I know, and we've said before, Oakland Avenue is underwater anytime it rains, and we can't have a city with a major road like that that's in that kind of condition. And the reason that's the case is because a lot of those water drainage lines, particularly in that part of the city, are 50 years old, and they haven't been repaired, and they haven't been maintained, and we know it, and it hasn't been corrected. And a lot of those roads are crumbling as well. I've got a good friend that said that his wife was at McLeod and that she was having surgery, and that it was abdominal surgery, and they were going to take her home, and he lives in Quimby, Eddie Thomas, you know, Eddie. And the doctors were concerned about him taking his wife up to Quimby from McLeod because of the conditions of the roads, and that the rough ride on the way up there might rip some of those stitches loose. Now, that is abominable. We can't, in a civilized city, a serious problem like that can't continue to exist, and it's a real problem, and we've got to address that problem of infrastructure. And finally, the last thing I would say is the thing that we've been talking about most recently, leadership and openness. We've got to have leadership, and I will be a mayor that will stand out in front, take a position. You will know where I stand on the Kingsburg Power Plant. I mean, you will know where I stand on where the library ought to be built. You will know where I stand on what the conditions of the schools are. And you know, I got some criticism after that debate, and people said, well, you know, Wakila, what's the mayor of Florence have to do with whether they're going to build a power plant down in Kingsburg? You're not the mayor of Kingsburg. I said, yeah, but you know what? We're going to breathe that same air, aren't we? We're going to have the same water. We're going to have the same fish. The mayor of Florence better get up on his hind legs and say what's going on in Kingsburg and represent the people of his city in that way. And I guarantee you will know my positions on the issues, and I will be open, and we'll have candid and open communication. And so that openness and leadership is the fifth thing I think that needs to be crucially brought to bear.
Okay. You talk about the openness, and when I first moved to Florence 20 years ago, 21 years ago, there was a mayor's committee, coalition, on anything and everything that was important to the city of Florence. As we've evolved through mayors, like Haig Kohler, Roger Pierce, we've kind of lost that in touchness with the community. Will you revitalize those types of committees?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they got to be more than in just name, too. I mean, the people of the community have got to be able to communicate with the mayor's office. Now, understand me, too. We ain't always going to agree.
Oh, I agree.
I mean, it just ain't going to happen. And I'm not going to be somebody who tries to be everything to everybody. It can't happen. But we've got to be able to communicate, and we've got to be honest with one another. And people have got to know, well, look, I disagree with the mayor on this, but I know he's being honest, and I know he's trying to do the best thing, and I know he's getting input from everybody and trying to make the best decision on a hard situation.
How would you make sure, lastly, how would you make sure that African-American small business especially is included in the process of the growth of Florence? I mean, there's been tremendous. I understand that there's going to be a new announcement this week on a new company coming in to the area. There was a Hines announcement a couple of weeks ago. We've been doing substantially well in terms of attracting new business to the community, whether it's been retail or whether it's been manufacturing or service businesses. How do you make sure that some of that pie is shared with small African-American businessmen?
Well, a couple things. I think first has to do with how we recruit business. And we spend a lot of time recruiting big box industry, and we do that with all kinds of tax breaks and tax incentives, and it brings business from out of town, and it's big business. And those big businesses, although they do bring jobs, they tend to be less well-paying jobs, jobs with less benefits, and they run small businessmen out of business, and we lose tax base because of them. I do think we ought to do that kind of search for job growth and big jobs as well, but we've also got to make sure that small businessmen gets the support he needs, that we don't lump sales tax on small businessmen at every turn, that we see that small businessmen get low interest and no interest loans to come downtown, that we see to it that when the city builds a project, that local businesses get those contracts, that minority businesses get those contracts. I was talking with Reverend Woodbury the other day about exactly that sort of thing, and I don't think our city has been sensitive enough to those issues, and we've got to concentrate on those issues.
We've been talking with Stephen Wakila. He's currently in the process of finalizing what we hope will be an opportunity for him to become the mayor of Florence, one of the youngest mayors of Florence. Just one other question. How do you think there is another young person in the process, Octavia Williams.
Yeah.
How do you think her being in the election process is going to benefit the overall process in November?
I'm very encouraged by Octavia's result. I think, and Octavia and I were talking about a lot of the same issues and a lot of the same things. We come from a lot of the same background.
Okay.
Young people who want to bring a change and who want to bring a new way of doing things. And I think that Octavia and I will be able to work very well together on the city council and make a big change. I hope she'll be elected in November.
That's going to be a challenge. It is a November election. For you who don't know, there is, I think it's November 4th.
I think
it's the election. Stephen, if he gets through the court system that he's going to be facing for the next few months in terms of his challenge from incumbent Mayor Frank Willis, will be running unopposed. Now, there are some people who believe, Stephen, that the mayor might even launch a write-in campaign. Are you one of those people?
The mayor can't do it himself.
Uh-huh.
As Democrats in South Carolina, we sign an oath
mm-hmm.
whenever you file to run as a Democrat for any office. So the mayor himself can't be involved in any write-in campaign and can't himself be on the ballot in November. I know that as a matter of law.
Mm-hmm.
They did it. Connecticut has different law, and you remember Joe Lieberman lost in the Democratic primary and
Indeed,
then ran
yeah.
as an independent and won. South Carolina would not allow that. South Carolina law would prevent that. I've heard the same rumors that other people want to try to drum up some opposition from the Republican side as a write-in. Of course, the official time for filing as Republican has long passed in March, and I have heard that too. I've talked to a number of people who said they've been approached about running as write-ins, and they have all declined, and in fact said they supported me. But I don't know that someone won't come up. If they do, so be it. But I think we'll be very strong in November, and I feel confident about being the winner in November.
Is that a petition drive? Does that have to happen to be a petition drive?
You can't even petition to put somebody on the candidate. You have to just organize people to actually write somebody's name in on election day. That's a very difficult process,
yeah,
you can imagine.
Very difficult
yeah.
process. Stephen, enjoyed talking with you. Good luck in this battle. Hopefully, you will come out on top. We believe that we're seeing the community take a new course, take a new direction, and we believe this is important not just to the black community but to the community as a whole. We've been looking for this type of change in the community for a long time, and I see it not just happening in Florence, but happening across the state of South Carolina. And it really is a good time to be in the state of South Carolina. So thank you for joining us today and thank you for being a part of this.
Thank you, Larry. I won't let you down.